You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, do you enjoy listening to Kick-Ass News? Well, then become a part of what I'm doing here and help support the show by going to patreon.com/kickassnews and making a donation. Your encouragement and support is always appreciated. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. Tomorrow night is the Season 3 premiere of AMC's critically acclaimed series Halt and Catch Fire. The title refers to a computer code that causes the computer's CPU to cease to operate and require a restart. It serves as a metaphor for the tech industry itself, where some other company is always on your heels trying to build a better mousetrap, and the ability to pivot and retool quickly is often the difference between being billionaires and being bankrupt. Much like the wily mavericks portrayed on their show, Halt and Catch Fire was created by two young upstart screenwriters named Chris Cantwell and Chris Rogers. While working together in the social media division at Disney, they wrote their first pilot script together for a series about the rise and fall of a fictional tech startup during the heyday of Texas's Silicon Prairie in the 1980s. They pitched it to three networks, and in their third meeting with AMC, the network behind Mad Men, Breaking Bad, and The Walking Dead, much to their surprise, AMC said yes, let's make it. Today I'll talk with the two Chrises about their experience learning on the job at Halt and Catch Fire and where the story is going now that they've taken over the showrunner and executive producer reins in Season 3. We'll talk about how Chris Cantwell's experience growing up during the 80s tech boom in Texas served as an early inspiration for he and Chris Rogers to write Halt and Catch Fire. They'll also reveal some of the other real-life personalities and stories that influenced the show. We'll talk about the tech industry and what kind of personalities rise to the top in it, and what kind of feedback the creators of Halt and Catch Fire have gotten from tech legends like Apple's Steve Wozniak. We'll discuss their decision to move the show's setting to Silicon Valley in Season 3 and shift the show's focus from the personal computing revolution of the early 80s to the birth of the internet in the middle part of that decade. Plus, we talk about robot butlers, and I find out who they'd rather be, Jobs or Woz. Coming up with Halt and Catch Fire's Chris Rogers and Chris Cantwell in just a moment. Today I'm joined by Chris Cantwell and Chris Rogers. They are the co-creators, the showrunners, and executive producers of AMC's Halt and Catch Fire, which is now about to start its third season on Tuesday, August 23rd. Guys, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Well, you guys created this series. It was really your first script, I think, and then not a common story that you hear. You guys got picked up by AMC. I think it was your third pitch.
Yeah, it was quite astounding for us. I think when Chris and I started writing together in August 2010. We sat down at Kohl's in downtown LA, and we kind of just said, what do we want to, what's the goal here? What's the end game? And we said, well, let's just work our way up. Maybe in 5 to 10 years, we'll have our own series on cable television. Tremendous good fortune allowed that to be the first thing that happened, which was crazy. We wrote one pilot together that got us representation, and they said, write something else so we can try to staff you. You know, we'll go up for staffing season. And we wrote Halt, and they said, well, let us send this to a couple places just to see what the interest is because we really like it. They sent it to HBO, Showtime, and AMC. And AMC was the last meeting we took where we just thought we're going in there, getting a bottle of water, hanging out for a little bit, and then taking off. And those three executives came in, and they all had copies of the script, and we ended up talking to them for a few hours, and it kind of just developed from there.
Your writer friends must hate you.
Yeah, there are a lot of people that hate us.
They must hate that.
I hate
us. This never happens in Hollywood.
Well, like, you know, I think because that's the case, I think the key all along has been to kind of admit what we don't know. And that's been such a big part of kind of our mantra, just because otherwise, you know, I think there were so many opportunities to get thrown off of this train, and the only reason we're still on it is because I think we were just earnest and passionate about that, you know, from day one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this third season is a big deal for you guys because you are now officially the showrunners on the show that you created. Are you somewhat glad that you had those first 2 years to kind of learn the ins and outs of making a dramatic series before you took over the reins and got thrown in the deep end here?
I thank God we had a showrunner in the first two seasons. Because we, like Chris said, we had never – the first writer's room we walked into was our own. And that was just surreal and crazy and anxiety-inducing for us. We were fortunate enough to work with Jonathan Liskow. And, you know, at first we didn't know him from Adam, but we met with him, and he came out of the John Wells School and was on mm-hmm. Southland before that. And
NYPD Blue,
yep,
is that right?
His first gig.
Start there.
Yep. Yeah. And he was such a veteran, but also such a great person on a human level. And sometimes you hear stories of creators and showrunners not getting along well. And it couldn't be farther from the truth with Jonathan. I think he, from the get-go, said, I'm interested in shepherding your vision for the show. And he meant it. He was very transparent with us, very open with us. He was an incredible mentor, a friend. We learned everything we do today on the show. We learned from him. To use Chris's sports metaphor, we run a John Liskow offense on our show.
Well, I've watched the first few episodes of the third season. I think people have a lot to look forward to. I love the show because, it's great writing. It's an interesting window on a world that most people didn't know about. And for me, it's fun on a personal level because, kind of like Chris Cantwell, I grew up in that world in Texas in the 80s.
Oh,
and
really?
My dad, you know, he was always keeping up with the tech boom and the companies that were coming up as an investor. And he loves to brag that he bought Compaq stock back when he still had to spell it for his own broker.
Nice.
Yeah. And was your dad, am I right, that he was a salesman in the computer industry
he
in
took
the
a
80s
sales
in
job.
Texas?
He took a sales job at a company called Ucell in Dallas. You should ask your dad if he remembers Ucell. It was around for a while. It was a big competitor of Computer Associates. And it was a system software company very much like Cardiff Electric. No one came in and forced them to go into the PC market. But that experience and that kind of transplant culture that was existing in Texas at the time, I think was something that we had never seen portrayed before and I thought was an interesting thing to tap into for Texas.
Yeah, and I've always wondered, what was it about Texas that drew the tech industry to it in the 80s as opposed to Silicon Valley or Boston or New York?
I mean,
have you figured that out in your research?
Well, and it totally existed in those other places you mentioned too. I mean, Boston actually was a big tech center too. But I think in Dallas, at least the version of it we embrace is that I think Dallas was a lot of people who were kind of capitalists and pragmatists and people that were kind of looking to bring kind of that, I hate to say frontier spirit, but the willingness to reverse engineer and to kind of be businessmen about it to an industry that in other places kind of was being handled less efficiently. And so we kind of felt like people like Texas Instrument or Compaq that, you know, that had kind of transferred out of other businesses like was it Tandy that used to be like a leather?
Charles Tandy a leather maker.
You know, there was an opportunism in like that. I think that was at least the initial impetus for why to set it in Texas, just because it felt like the story people didn't know about kind of the other people who really contributed to the tech story that I think we all on some level think we understand.
Yeah, because that people forget there was Compaq, Dell, Tandy, TI. And, you know, people think Texas in the 80s, they think oil and J.R. Ewing. Mm-hmm. They don't think computers. Well, Chris, I'm curious, is the character of Bosworth a little bit based on your dad?
No.
No?
My dad?
Not at all? I mean, aside from he didn't go to prison, I assume.
No, not yet. I wouldn't be surprised if he did. I think that my dad likes to think that he's Joe. I think I won't sell my dad up the river entirely. There's one scene in the show that is verbatim from my dad's experience, and that's in the pilot when Joe goes out on the sales call with Gordon. It's the first time they actually really interact, and Gordon interrupts Joe when he's trying to close the deal. And then later in the parking lot, Joe says, "Hey, the next time I move to close, this is what you do," and he yells at him to shut up. My dad did that to his sales engineer. That's a legit thing my dad did to somebody. I imagine that guy seeing the show and just like sitting up in his chair and being like, "What? I thought no one knew about this." But that's it. I mean, I think my dad would probably have been a guy that he was very much a salesman that would have worked at a company like Cardiff Electric. He would have worked for guys like John Bosworth, and that very much influenced that character, at least initially.
There's always this tug of war between the tech geeks and the pitch man, the salesman, the visionary. And you don't see that just with Joe and with Gordon, but you see that also with the women in the show. And have you come to any conclusion over what is the more valuable side of that equation when you're talking in the tech industry?
I mean, it's interesting. The show has a lot of parallels, in our opinion, to the entertainment industry in that, you have to be able to sell it. You have to be able to make people see it before they're willing to invest in it, but then you have to have the goods. So no one character on Halt and Catch Fire has all of the tools. You know, nobody can do it themselves and pitch it effectively and, kind of oversee the process of bringing people together to make something great. And so they kind of need each other. At least that was the way we kind of constructed it. At the end of the day, I think you got to know the zeros and ones. But at the same time, we have a new character in our third season, Ryan Ray, who couldn't be better at that and couldn't be worse at the other thing. And that's, why he's drawn to Joe McMillan. So we think there's a value on all those. And I think the greats that we remember tend to skew one way or the other.
Well, now I'll ask both of you, which would you rather be, Steve Jobs or Woz?
Oh,
I mean, aside from the fact that Steve Jobs dead.
So well, yeah.
Take that out of the equation.
I don't know. That's a hard one.
Woz is probably a pretty happy guy. I mean, he rides around on his Segways.
He seems
that's
happier.
What I hear.
Has some planes.
He does seem happy.
Yeah.
He's got a metal business card. I mean,
he does have a metal business card. That's super cool.
He's like a sweet guy.
Now, have you guys ever met Woz?
We did. We met him
really?
At South by Southwest when we premiered the pilot episode. He actually introduced it, and then he did our panel of questions with you, me, and Jonathan, and the actors, and Carl Ledbetter, our tech consultant.
Oh, that's incredible.
It was great. And he actually, one of the funny things that happened was that he had all of his questions written on his iPhone, and he was working through his questions, and then he set his iPhone down on his knee and accidentally deleted the window, or like closed the window with all of his questions in there, and then he picked it up, and he was like, "Well, I guess I'll just wing it." And then he was like, "What's a showrunner?"
No, I believe the question was, "What does a runner do?"
Yeah, exactly. What does a runner do? And he was great. He was a lot of fun.
I would think an iPhone would be kind of small print for an interview.
Yeah, but it's like so convenient, right? I mean, yeah. I've used
my iPad before, but
it's.
Well, a lot of people and critics have said the first season was finding its legs, like most series, really. Mm-hmm. And then the second season, it really started to blossom. What was the turning point, or what do you feel worked better for you guys in the second season?
I mean, I think that's been the narrative, that the second season kind of found its
right.
Feet. And for us, that maybe is a little simplistic, just in that we kind of feel like it really kind of paralleled our understanding of what our show was. And I think that's something that you can kind of really see taking root halfway through the first season. You know, is around like episode 5, 6, I think the show really starts to find an energy and a tone and a fun that carries over into the second season. obviously we start to tell the story of Mutiny, which really felt to us like where the show wanted to go, you know, because it was fun and I think it set it apart, and it was something we had that other shows didn't, and you can kind of just tell from the electricity in the room that people like that, like it's neon, it's fun, we're making jokes, you know, like it's got this arcade freneticism to it. You know, so that guided us a lot, and I think that was a lot of like the righteous wind at the back of the second season, obviously with Cameron and Donna's kind of female partnership at the center of it. But you know, for us, I think it was the process of moving out of the shadow of the shows we admired and the shows that we kind of built the show emulating, and kind of finding the show that was ours.
I don't think the second season could exist without the first, and I think that is in terms of the story and also in terms of the process. Like Chris said, we were learning and learning what the show was, learning how to make a show. Once we started to color outside the lines, I think that's when it started to really turn into something else. And for me, it's a specific scene, and it's the end of episode 5, and it's when Joe takes a sledgehammer to a car.
Yeah,
and he's doing it as part of a company event, and he shares this insane electric look with Cameron, and I think just from that moment on, we were on a different track with the story, that we could set up these characters, we could set up these archetypes of the bulletproof salesman, the misunderstood genius, the housewife, the prodigy, the hard ass boss, and then we could just start to explode those. I think that's something that we wanted to do. From the get-go, it just took us a minute to figure out how to do it. And I think that once we did, then everything was on the table.
Yeah, and in the second season, it really has become more about the women. Mm-hmm. And was that always the intention? Did the series kind of take you in that direction
itself? I think you really write to what's working, which is not to say to the detriment of the men, who I think continue to be a vital part of the show, an equal and vital part of the show. But there was just something unplanned and wonderful that happened there. You know, I mean, you put the pieces on the board, and Donna is a housewife who wants to be more, but is also a talented engineer. And, you know, Cameron is this kind of electric, unruly person that comes into Cardiff Electric and you know, exists between Gordon and Joe. But then those two suddenly had scenes together, and suddenly there was something there, and suddenly there was an idea and a chemistry. And, you know, you really have to listen to what's working, and that just felt great to us. And then those two actresses obviously just kind of earned it and earned it and earned it, you know, and so it felt great to kind of build around that. And that also felt like a story that hadn't been told. I mean, I think you can see, you know, the Don Draper and the ideas behind Joe. I mean, I think you can see the Walter White and the ideas behind Gordon initially, but it really kind of felt like we were in new and exciting territory, and we were kind of pushing the envelope, and we had Donna and Cameron out at the head of this company in a, you know, a time when women were historically a little more represented in the tech industry, and frankly, a time right before they ceased to be. So it also kind of just, you know, felt important and fun and resonant.
Yeah, and, you know, since you brought up Mad Men, are you kind of glad to be out of the shadow of Mad Men now? Because the first season, and I feel this was an unfair comparison, everyone was comparing the character of Joe, because he's an alpha male. Yeah, I mean, everyone was making that comparison to Don Draper.
We're still getting it. I mean, to be honest, we're still getting, like, if you don't know what it is, you know, and think Mad Men, but in the age of computers, I'm like, really? It looks nothing like Mad Men at any part at this point.
Yeah.
I just feel like it's completely different. I understand how the relative human mind works and looks for associations. I think, yes, you can definitely see the parallels like Chris is talking about in the first season. I think what was fun about the first season is that, you know, Joe and Gordon were the upstarts and the roguish ones at the very beginning, who come into this staid company and kind of explode it from the inside. Mm-hmm. The fun part of season one is that by the end, those guys are the old guard. They're the ones being rebelled against by Donna and Cameron.
Yeah. Which is how this industry works.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
You know, Bill Gates was the upstart, and now he's the one that everyone wanted to take down.
And now Apple is the one that seems to be, it's becoming, you know, it seems to be taking the place of Microsoft and IBM before it. And, you know, we want to continue that story. I think that, you know, in season three, I think there's a lot of existential questioning that Cameron and Donna are going to have to do once they enter the big leagues, and it becomes about making money and, quote unquote, succeeding.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer a fun house full of kids. It's a place of business.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with the creators of AMC's Halt and Catch Fire, Chris Cantwell and Chris Rogers. We'll be back in just a moment. Hey, folks, do you like reading but find it's getting harder and harder to make time to curl up with a good book? Well, there's a solution. Give audiobooks a try. They're perfect for your commute to work or working out at the gym, a relaxing bath, or any time, really. And right now, you can take an audiobook for a spin with a special promotion just for our listeners from Audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickassnews. to get a free 30-day trial and download any of Audible's 180,000 titles entirely for free. That's audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. The third season premieres on August 23rd. I watched the first few episodes. I think that fans are really going to love the third season. It's just building and building. And I think in the second season, you set up several payoffs that come to fruition in the third season. In the second season, you had all of these characters kind of go off on their own path in disparate directions. And then they all kind of come back together as everyone moves to Silicon Valley. And I feel that everyone watching this for the past two seasons has been watching and thinking, okay, when are they going to get to Silicon Valley? So I feel that that's a big payoff for the audience. But for you guys, I'm curious if as the creators, it's somewhat bittersweet or something of a trade-off. Finally, the characters selling out and going off to Silicon Valley and leaving Texas, leaving the Silicon Prairie.
You know, and I'll give Cantwell a shot at this one too, because I'm not a native Texan, but I will say what's great about a third season is often in characters, there's a little bit of like a dualism to their choices. You know, Joe's being good or he's being bad. The Clark marriage is going well or it's going poorly. And I think what a third season gives you the opportunity to do is explore like the weird third place it could go to really think outside the box. And so we got to do kind of pairings we hadn't done before. We got to do a lot of like Gordon and Cameron. We got to, I think for my money, the Joe of the third season is this incredible synthesis of the guy from the first two seasons, and I think it's probably his best season that we've done. And so, I mean, I think what was wonderful about kind of taking all these relationships forged in Texas and moving them to California and making the actual place they are an antagonist, a new one, you know, putting them in the Shark Tank, putting them in the big leagues, kind of taking them out of the comfort of their surroundings and kind of making everything new, was that it was kind of a wonderful reset to kind of look at these interesting evolutions of the characters and ask ourselves how far we've changed. So, you know, for me, I think it was all payoff, and it felt kind of insincere in a way to keep them away from California any longer. I think it would have been artificial to continue to say that, you know, that Texas was the epicenter of this once we get into 86 and kind of beyond, which is where the third season takes place. But, you know, at the same time, I think it was sad to leave the land of barbecue and, you know, it certainly gave us our start.
That was my thing. I think I'm sad that I can't put like oblique references to my high school in there anymore, or like reference, you know, Inwood Road. But I think that there's a reason why people go, oh, Texas was part of the tech industry. And I think that's because all roads eventually lead to Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
And it really starts to become the epicenter around the time that season three is taking place. And, you know, obviously there are still major tech companies in Texas and now all over the world, but it is because the industry became so white hot in California, specifically around this time and into the 90s, that it kind of blinds some of the history when you look back. So I think it was an interesting way in, but if like Chris said, if we kept the characters off those roads that led there, it would have started to felt too implausible. I mean, like, what are you doing, guys?
Yeah. Okay, so it's still very much the early days of the internet.
Yeah, I think the internet has yet to be launched in the form of what is known now today as the internet backbone or NSFNet. But it is just about to be, and, you know, something that is definitely on the playing field for our actual story in the season.
Yeah, and it's funny because I had Steve Case on about a month ago, the
That's
founder
awesome.
Of AOL.
Yeah, so great. Yeah.
And I was listening to him tell all these stories from the early days of AOL, and I told him this. I said, it sounds a lot like Halt and Catch Fire, everything that you're telling me, you know, plans falling through and having to instantly figure out something else and pivot. So much of that. He was talking about how I think it was Prodigy or whatever the other one, the other competitor.
CompuServe
mm-hmm. had this thing where they were so eager to cash out that they were selling email ads. And AOL just started, got the idea, we're just going to start buying email ads, ad bursts that they were then Prodigy or whoever was sending out to their users to lure
Prodigy.
Them over to AOL. And it was a year before they even realized that this was going on, that they made a mistake, that they had screwed up. He got millions and millions of subscribers off of their
Steve
advertising
Case is
deal.
One of those guys where, when we found out we were going to run the third season, we we decided to rent a house in Joshua Tree for a weekend and go up there and just kind of like get on the same page and kind of brainstorm about what it could be. And we took just a ton of library books from the LA Central Library and a lot of stuff that we thought kind of might be fertile ground for where we could go in a third season, because you always kind of have some big ideas, but you have to be ready to kind of throw them out and kind of see what excites you. And I have this very distinct memory of like sitting on some kind of weird boulder reading like a Steve Case biography in Joshua
Tree. Oh, really?
Because,
it's probably the same
He's
book.
Definitely a guy we mine for some of this stuff and Von Meester and those other interesting guys kind of from his orbit and in the Viewtron days and Q-Link. So I think we're always looking to kind of knit our story together with pieces of companies you end up knowing, telling never the story of one entity, but he's a fascinating guy, and the story of him camping out in the Apple lobby until they decide to make Apple Link is an incredible one, very cool that you got to interview.
Yeah, and it sounds like you guys are pretty research heavy. You do your homework. One of the things I like about it is that it is very much of the 80s. And you see, there's the cocaine parties and there's a reference to AIDS in one of these recent episodes that I was watching. And one thing that I love is you have the robot butler. I can still remember as a kid when that came out. Oh, the robot butler. I want a robot butler. We're selling them for God knows how much money. These stupid little butlers that really didn't do anything. And we thought that the age of robots was so close in the 80s.
And that we will give credit to the writer of that episode. Michael Saltzman, who I think literally experienced receiving a robot butler from his dad and having that exact conversation that Boz and Gordon and Ryan do, which is, if you have to make the drinks and put it in its hand and then walk on the other side of the room and have it walk over or drive over to you, why not just drink the drink? And it made it into the show. It's one of my favorite moments in the series.
So we tape these little vignettes for like inside the episode at the end of the season. And, you sit there and it's a long day and you answer a lot of questions. And at the end of it, they're like, what was your favorite moment of the series? And you could tell they just wanted something juicy that they could use in the videos. And I think we were both like, probably the robot butler. Yeah, probably the robot. And you could just kind of see them being like, we're not going to use that.
Yeah, because I'm a little older than you two. Yeah. And I can remember as a kid wanting that for Christmas and thinking that would be so cool. And it really didn't do anything.
It's funny.
Now we really are approaching the age of robots, because now it's finally coming to fruition where they finally have the technology that robots really are becoming a thing.
Rocky IV is to blame too. I think.
Rocky,
even
Stallone, who does not apologize for anything, has said, "I shouldn't have done that," which is great. But I think you should have, and it's like the best part of that movie.
Well, maybe I'm just interpreting this, but are we witnessing the Steve Jobsification of Joe McMillan in the third season?
I think
he's getting pretty jobsy.
He's getting pretty jobsy in here. I think that the short answer is yes. In that. The cult of personality around technology is something that was really starting to brew around this time.
Mm-hmm.
Jobs was probably there a little earlier, but I think the famous Playboy interview with him with the picture of him on the floor was 85. Mm-hmm. And Joe is a guy who we thought just dovetails so well into wanting to just live in a persona. And this is one he's clearly desired for some time, to be known as the guy. And so this kind of guru image that we see him in season three, I think we see an ease and a confidence in Joe that we almost haven't seen before, because it's more true to who he is. He can kind of just be his eccentric self. I think that Joe is actually kind of a pretty strange guy in a great way. But the thing that we wanted to do to cut against that, because we didn't want it to just be emulative of something else, was that Joe, at the same time, is very closed off from everybody, and he's actually a little dimmed in inspiration because of all of the emotional damage he suffered mm-hmm. off of season one and season two.
Yeah,
he's really cut loose everybody who has been important to him in his life. You know, Cameron, Gordon, his wife, Sarah, his father. I mean, like, he has nobody, and he's really paranoid and defensive. And so we thought that was an interesting contrast to the guy who can sit there in the corner office with the bamboo floors and just give out little Cohens of tech wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Now, is Joe redeemable? Is there a redemption for him, or are you just screwing with us?
I mean, I think Joe, we were really excited to move Joe to San Francisco and Silicon Valley because, you know, we really like to draw the parallel between that reinvention. I think Joe is a guy who is constantly reinventing himself as the circumstances require. But with people like that, I think you always have to ask the question, is that a finite resource? You know, is it ever too many times? And I think in the course of the season, we hear Joe say, I'm not sure I've got another reinvention in me. Mm-hmm. In many ways, we wanted this season to be the story of Joe falling back in love with technology. Joe has kind of figured out a brilliant scam, you know, that is kind of personality based. The idea of person as product is something we're really playing in that kind of Jobsian vein at the top of the season with Joe at the head of, you know, what is really not a very sexy industry and antivirus, but I think he's really kind of sold himself to consumers and people out there as kind of a confidence man. And he's made his peace with that, seemingly. And I think this season's about him getting his soul back. So in our mind,
there is a little bit of redemption, at least for now.
Yeah, I think so. And there's two important distinctions, I think, that Lee Pace actually made to us early on in the series, which is that Joe is a zealot. He really loves this stuff. This is the story of him falling back in love, but he's not a snake oil salesman. He believes it.
We
see him actually for the first time at the top of season three being a little snake oily. And being okay with that, but I think it cuts against the character, and he's kind of self-aware of that. So I think in his passion, there's an innocence and a purity, and I think that's key to the character's redemption. And I think that in tandem with that, you know, Lee pointed out to us a while ago that Joe's a lonely guy. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a strange guy, and he has a lot of trouble connecting with people. All the characters do in their own way.
Yeah.
And everything that they do in technology is about that. And I think we want Joe to be happy on some level. I think we love him because he is really in his own warped ways trying to connect with human beings.
Yeah, and I think the farther you get into the first season and the second season and now, you see the other characters. He's not the only insane, self-destructive person on the show. It kind of infuses the show. And with the other characters like Cameron and Gordon – is there something in that industry that you have to be a little bit insane and even self-destructive to really get ahead in tech?
Oh, interesting. I mean, I think the characters, we've always wanted to play fair with the fact that they live close to and in proximity to one another, you know, so they're going to rub off on each other. And I think in some ways, some of the characters aspire to be each other, at least in their better light. But I mean, the central premise of the show has always been that people bake themselves into the things they create, you know, and so the products aren't perfect because the people aren't perfect and the process that created them are certainly, you know, is very fraught on our show. So, you know, do you have to, I think you have to be a little unhappy, I will say, on our show. I mean, it seems like if these people were ever content,
the
show would be over. You know, everybody got money at some point. Everybody kind of got to be the head of something. And, you know, if everyone could just learn to go to the beach house and take up surfing, like it would, we'd be done. But I think everybody feels driven by this need to be part of something that matters, to guess the future, to really make some kind of, you know, monolithic change in the world. And in that, you know, while it inspires the creation of great things, I think also prevents one from resting, from really being at peace or happy. And so I think our characters all unfortunately suffer from that disease.
I think so. I think that, you know, and that's a fairly universal thing. I was just reading a book right as we were finishing the end of the season three, and there's a biological response in the brain that as soon as you receive something or earn something, it triggers craving for more and fear that you will lose it. And the third thing that happens is contentment, but it's very difficult to get past the first two. And that is just an endless cycle that we all get stuck in, and I think the tech is really an allegory for that. It's really the character's ambitions that are the most dangerous thing about them.
You know, the other thing with this particular show that I think makes it really interesting for viewers and keeps it kinetic is that in the tech industry, you do have that thing where you have to constantly be nimble. Like I said with Steve Case, you have to constantly be adjusting into changing situations, pivoting. And throughout the show, you see that several times, sometimes even in a season, the floor falls out from under them. You have Cameron who started the gaming company, and then from the gaming company, it's turning into Chad. And now in this third season, it's evolving into something entirely different. It's exciting. You never really know what's going to happen. And I think it's realistic. I think that's probably how, from what I hear, how the industry really is. A lot of risk. You know, you have to be a bit of a riverboat gambler, I guess, to go into the tech industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, are you guys tech geeks? I know that you guys kind of met working for in the social media wing over at Disney, huh?
Yeah, we did.
Probably not. Yeah. I mean, I think is the answer. We probably both have to answer this separately, but you know, we definitely met kind of in the process of helping Disney kind of port its big properties over to Facebook. Mm-hmm. Chris actually hired me. I'd come out of magazines, and Chris was a creative
That's
director.
Right.
Over there, making kind of
does he hang that over your head
videos?
Whenever you guys have creative differences now?
That doesn't get me very far.
I've been fired several times. So I think we met in that place, but I think we're people kind of as we've got into writing that have realized we're a little more old school than we thought. You know, we tend to gravitate towards kind of long form journalism and movies from the '70s.
Right,
and
you came out of journalism, you said.
Yeah. And we're kind of greatly pained by sometimes the social media that one is exposed to as the creator of an artistic product. The feedback. Yeah. So I think we have a great interest in the technology world, but it's a little more anthropological. Would that be safe to say?
I think so. Yeah. I think you know, it's something that I'm fascinated by, and how it is just continues to be more and more interwoven into every aspect of our lives. I think that also freaks me out. I think we spend so much time writing about it that I get a little saturated and a little meta mm-hmm. about the technology mm-hmm. in my own life. And it actually makes me more aware, probably in a good way, and conscious about what I'm doing with technology. But it's something that I've tracked and just kind of, you know, earmarked as I've gone along through my life thus far. I mean, I went to USC Film School, and I was the first.
Same here.
There you go. What was your major?
I did the bullshit major. That was critical studies.
Critical studies.
Yeah, I didn't go for production. You know, I wanted to get in and out.
I understand. I was a writing major.
Okay.
I was a writing major.
Okay.
And but I was the first digital class at SC. So I was the first class where we were shooting on digital camcorders. We were editing in the Avid Express suites in the Zemeckis Center that they had just built. I never touched a piece of celluloid in film school. It's very strange.
Did you take classes with Drew Casper?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God, yes.
Now, the audience wouldn't know, but Drew Casper is this legendary film professor at USC.
He comes up. I think he's come up in a couple other interviews we've done, hasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Good evening, everybody.
Yeah. And he reminds me of, like, the gay Jack Palance.
He's incredible.
He looks like Jack Palance, but...
He's like, tonight's film is Star Wars, a 1977 venture from George Lucas, who went here, along with his wife, Marsha.
He was brilliant. And there was a story where he got arrested for sneaking into a movie. Oh, this was probably in between the time I went to USC and you guys. Every Friday he would talk about he would go see two movies. He would pay for one. He would bring his empty bag of popcorn, get a refill, and then sneak into a second movie. And after years of him doing this, he got caught. And he got arrested. And they asked the dean of the school in the USC paper, they asked her for a comment. And she said, I'm not upset that he got arrested for sneaking into a movie. I'm upset that he got arrested for sneaking into Dude, Where's My Car?
that's fantastic. Jeez, wow. I don't know that story. That's amazing.
Well, before we go, do you guys hear from other Silicon Valley tech types aside from Wozniak? What do they say?
We do, and this is always the part.
Are they annoying? Like,
they're wonderful, and I'm right now I'm trying to decide if we're betraying their confidence by naming them, but I suppose we're not. No, because it matters to us to get it right. I will say we when we set out to make this show, we said we were going to really kind of super serve the people that lived this, and we are committed to, when you see something on a whiteboard, when you see something on a screen, it's not just going to be a lot of bullshit zeros and ones. It's going to be real, and we're going to get it right, and we're going to interview and read about the people who actually did this and try to do right by them. And so the highest compliment we get is when people reach out and say, that's it, like, and that I lived it, and you know. Everybody always has a theory about who we're talking about. It's like, are you talking about this guy who was in the cubicle over from me? It's no, but you know, I'm glad that you think that. And so, yeah, we've been very flattered to have people like Mark Cuban, you know, people like Michael Dell, people like Mark Andreessen call the show out for its authenticity and its fidelity.
That's great. That's going to be hard to do with those types, I imagine.
They
have to be hard to please on the tech, I imagine.
It's always a nice boost when one of those people reaches out and says you got it right. And I think that along with that though is also when I still remember when we got to screen the pilot for Apple, and so we went up and screened it for Apple, and you know, even in season one, some of the things we were being criticized for. You know, or people were a little suspect of were the fact that we had not one but two female engineers in the show as main characters, especially at that time period. And, you know, right after we screened the pilot, there was a woman who came up to me who had been at Apple since that year and the year that is portrayed in the show. And she said that I lived that, like that's I got into computers in the same way Cameron did. Thank you so much for finally telling this side of it. And that's something that we really enjoy, too, is when we get that right. When a lot of people go, oh, that didn't happen. It's like, no, you know what? It did. There were actually more women per capita in getting computer engineering and computer science degrees than there are now. And there were women taking their companies public. There were women building computers. There were women who were designing video games. They were there, and I'm glad that we can reflect some of that history.
Yeah.
Are you ever tempted to have real life characters do an appearance on the show, or either as themselves or have, you know, oh, who's this clown? Oh, his name is Paul Allen. he'll never get anywhere, you know. Or is there that danger that it just turns into Forrest Gump?
I think increasingly we're interested in that. There is a cameo this season. You know, if you look closely, kind of towards the end. And we always like to make little kind of in jokes about the technology and people that are going on. But, you know, it's tricky, right? Like, we didn't want to come out the gate with a lot of that, with Steve Jobs, I saw him at the coffee, you know, I saw him pulling his car out of this garage. I guess he was making space for something. You don't want to, like, make the really on-the-nose reference, but I think as we go along, we start to have a little more fun with the cameos of the people who existed.
Well, terrific. Like I said, any fans of the show, I think, are going to be really happy with the third season. It premieres on Tuesday, August 23rd. Chris Cantwell and Chris Rogers, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having us.
Love the show. Thanks again to Chris Cantwell and Chris Rogers for coming on the show. The season 3 premiere of Halt and Catch Fire airs tomorrow night, Tuesday, August 23rd at 9 p.m. Eastern on AMC. Visit AMC.com for more information, including previews, behind-the-scenes extras, and cast and crew interviews. You can follow Chris Rogers on Twitter at CCR, and Chris Cantwell's Twitter handle, and this is kind of funny, is @ifyoucantwell. That's @ifyoucantwell. Good luck to the guys on season 3, and I highly recommend you check it out. It's seriously one of the best things on TV. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter @KAPolitics. And please be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign gofundme.com/kickassnews. Or make a recurring donation at patreon.com/kickassnews. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnewspodcast.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.
Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.